My biggest fear with, even as a kid, with babysitting is I was always worried I would end up babysitting either the twins from The Shining or any of the children on British television. I mean, it creeps me out either way.
Any of the children on British television?
Any child on any British TV show. I don't know what it is.
Like the Tomorrow People just really
creep
you the fuck out?
Oh my God. More like the Yesterday People. Put those bastards in my rearview mirror. I do not want to see them. It's terrifying. I don't know if that makes me weird or... Yeah, it probably makes me weird.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Everybody, welcome to Junk Food Cinema. This is the weekly cult and film and cult and film. Let's try that again. Let's not edit it. Let's just do another take. Welcome to Junk Food Cinema. This is Film School Reject's weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good we just had to say that twice. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I am joined, of course, by my friend and colleague and screenwriting and megaforcing, and you know who I'm talking about.
Wow, this show is just chock full of quality this week.
C. Robert Cargill. I feel like if you're on board in August of our... We've been on the air for over a year. I feel like at this point you should probably know what it is that you're dealing with and not have any undue expectations of highbrow or high quality.
Or professionalism.
No. Oh my God, no. Are you kidding me? Where we're sitting right now? No, there's
no. We are sitting in your little sex dungeon gum movie room.
I'm gonna go with theater room, but again, the sex dungeon seems to be a popular nom de guerre of this particular chamber. So sure, why not? You guys can find more professionalism and high quality broadcasting of this ilk on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and you can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. Now, we have entered a new month, which means, of course, it is time for a new theme.
That's right.
New theme time at Junk Food Cinema. And we were a little lapsed about telling you guys what the theme is this month. So let me go ahead and lay it out for you. It happened one night.
Yeah.
We're not gonna talk about that one movie for 3 weeks. That's not what I mean. We are gonna
could totally do that.
We could, absolutely. We could absolutely do that. But instead, what we're going to do is we're gonna be talking about our favorite films in which the plot unfolds over a single evening. I think there was another name for those type of films. Something more film school appropriate, something more educational, something more academic. I can't remember what it is. So movies that take place over the course of one evening, single night movies, that is what we're doing. This week, we're going to start with Adventures in Babysitting. And we will be following that up next week, just so you guys can play along at home. We'll be following up that next week with Judgment Night.
Oh, yeah.
And then
bringing back the 90s. We got some 80s. We got some 90s.
Yeah, we are all over the place. And, of course, finishing strong with After Hours, which is a film that I feel like does not get enough attention.
Oh, dude, the forgotten Scorsese.
The forgotten Scorsese.
Everybody's like, oh, these are Scorsese did this and this and this and this, and then nobody ever mentions After Hours, which is fantastic.
Absolutely is. So today, as I mentioned, we're going to be talking about 1987's Adventures in Babysitting.
This is the night when things go from bad to worse.
Now, Cargill, I don't know what your relationship was with this movie, but I know when I was a kid, this is one of those movies that I watched until the damn tape broke. I loved this movie.
Yeah, no, same here. I'm a little older, so...
Than most buildings.
Yes. Have we really gotten to that point yet where we're using the old Martin Thomas jokes on me?
Or the old Friends jokes.
I remember when the talk is happened.
In my day, movies came on these black cassette tapes, or possibly on these flat discs, but not like your fancy Blu-rays. These were big discs.
They came in big sleeves, and you stuck the sleeve in and then pulled the sleeve out and then held onto the disc.
It looked like a saw blade, but good luck chopping down any trees with it.
Yeah, no, so I saw this at the theater, and I actually saw it twice in the theater. I absolutely love this movie. It was a really good, fun, raucous comedy. You know, from an era where, you know, when they made family comedies, when they made comedies that were kind of geared towards kids a bit, and they made them edgy, and
yeah.
They had swears, and mm-hmm. they had Playboy magazine references, and,
yep.
you know, just all the kind of B.B. King out of nowhere, you know, just, you know, crazy shit. And so, you know, this is one of those really fun movies from that era before we got really, really uptight about what we showed our kids.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, the stuff that we grew up on. So,
well, it's interesting you mentioned that, too, because this was actually the first PG-13 title that Disney put out. Like, this was the first for them. Now, that rating was very new.
Yeah.
But this was the first title to be released, a PG-13 title to be released by Disney. And I have to agree, like, there is an edginess to it. And I mean, not only are we talking about characters referencing Playboys or looking at Playboys, but Playboys actually factoring in very highly into the plot, like being
major
story points.
Yeah, no, in fact, my wife had never seen it. This was one of those movies that she had somehow missed.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I decided to watch it last night, she's like, oh, I've never seen that. I'm like, you've never seen this. All right.
It's so good, though.
Let's crack open a bottle of wine and have fun. And then, of course, you know, it mentions that she looks like Miss March.
Mm-hmm.
Not the shitty movie, but
No,
actual Miss March. And
sorry to disappoint anyone who thought we might talk about Miss March on this podcast. That is not going to happen.
Chiefly, like the two or three people involved in making that movie. But once that gets mentioned, my wife just kind of gives me a weird look, and I go, "Don't worry, honey, that's a plot point." And then, sure enough, it comes up repeatedly, and she's like, "Wow, this whole movie's kind of about mistaken identity and Playboy magazine."
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, it's,
which is kind of awesome.
And, you know, and a lot of these movies, I mean, the other major, factor of this movie, the driving force behind it, is something that actually propels every single movie we're going to talk about this month. And that is the idea of all of these movies being experiments in Murphy's Law. All of these being movies about everything that can go wrong does go wrong. And you take a very simple situation, a very simple, just jaunt home or a night out, whatever the case may be, being interrupted by a series of completely off-the-wall circumstances. And I think what makes a good movie like this versus, let's say, Meet the Parents, is that you really have to, one, buy into the reason and appreciate the reason that your main character is progressively sinking into these circumstances. And also, just how overblown and exaggerated they are, because a lot of the things that happen in Adventures in Babysitting, yeah, I mean, they're a little over the top, perhaps, but they're not so insane that you couldn't bend your disbelief a little bit. You don't even have to really suspend it; just bend it a bit. And I think that's what makes this movie work really well. And if you haven't seen this, the plot is very simple in that it revolves around our main character, Chris, who is played by the beautiful, the lovable, the adorable Elizabeth Shue. And Elizabeth Shue, at the beginning of the movie, is very excited. She's about to go on her anniversary dinner with her boyfriend, Brad.
Bradley Whitford.
Bradley fucking Whitford. No, he's not. What's his name? Mike. Mike is.
Yeah,
I'm getting confused because there's a character named Brad in the movie, and
yeah,
he's Bradley Whitford.
You'll look at him and say you'll want that. Everyone else will call him Mike, and you'll be fuck you.
Nah,
it's
Brad.
Whitford.
It's Bradley,
that's Bradley Whitford.
Whitford
playing the too cool for school fucking high school kid,
literally with a Camaro and a license plate that says
"So cool,
so cool," which hilariously was not a prop. I found out it was actually Bradley Whitford's Camaro. replete with Bradley Whitford's vanity license plate.
That's kind of amazing. I kind of want to hope and pray that it was irony and that in the, because he's a very funny guy.
So funny.
So that maybe he just thought it would be funny to like be the douche-tastic wonder. But then there's part of me that's like, but it was the 80s and,
Well, he had been in movies like Doorman and The Betty Ford Story by this point in his career, so he probably was feeling too or so cool. Or no, this is hilarious. This is so early on in his career that you could barely find a credit to his name up to like one episode of The Equalizer. Yep, you made it, man. You buy that Camaro and you get that vanity plate that says so cool, because someday you know what? You have the balls to know, Bradley Whitford, that someday you will in fact be so cool. So that date goes awry. He calls it off. His sister's sick. And Chris's friend Brenda is tapped to watch these kids tonight, and instead convinces Elizabeth Shue to do it so that she can go downtown to this party. So standard babysitting job, not a big deal, a little forced upon her. But wouldn't you know it, something happens to Brenda. She gets stranded downtown. Brenda, by the way, played by Penelope Ann Miller. Yeah. Like, I think a lot of people forget that Penelope Ann Miller's in this movie, too.
Oh, yeah. No, it's this movie. The thing that is really amazing about this movie is just the incredibly wonderful young cast that, like, almost every cameo in this movie, you're like, oh, holy shit. And then it has the mother of all cameos. Like, it literally has the single greatest cameo of the 80s, a cameo my wife didn't even know existed. And I built up the entire movie. And when it finally fucking happened, she's like, no fucking way.
Yes fucking way.
Yes fucking way. She's like, no fucking way. Yes fucking way.
You'll have we'll to stay tuned to this whole episode to find out who we're talking, except for the majority of people are like, I've seen this movie. I know who you're talking about.
Oh, yeah, no. And but they won't disagree when I say the mother of all cameos.
Yeah.
Like, it's a cameo up there with like when Sean Connery shows up at the end of Robin Hood. Like, it's like that epic level of, holy fuck, what the fuck are you doing in this movie, doing something awesome? Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
Yeah, so Penelope Ann Miller, you know, this is very early in her career as well, before she would go on to be, you know, one of the go-to young, attractive girls in blockbuster movies mm-hmm. throughout the 90s.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Penelope Ann Miller with glasses.
So she's with giant glasses, is stranded downtown and needs Chris to come save her. And so Elizabeth Shue's character has to make a tough decision, because it's like, yes, I don't want to be taking these kids with me downtown, but like, I can't leave them alone. And wouldn't you know it, like the boy of the family, Brad, he has this best friend, Daryl, who is a total fucking skeez. But they basically,
he's the sleazeball best friend.
Absolutely.
Which was one of the staples of 80s comedy.
Yeah. He's not played by Willie Ames.
No. Cause Willie
not
Ames,
in this case.
Willie Ames was for a time the single greatest sleazeball wingman.
Yep, that's what he did.
Until George Clooney one-upped him in Return of the Killer Tomatoes and proved that he out Willie Amesed Willie Ames.
You know, another movie he out Willie Amesed in that no one ever saw was Grizzly 2, but
he didn't go full Willie Ames.
I don't know.
Grizzly 2.
I think he very much aimed for Ames, I think, and I think he may have hit that target. So here they all are, piling into the station wagon, forced to go downtown to save Brenda. And here immediately is where I want to draw a line of distinction. Did you ever see The Sitter with Jonah Hill from a couple years ago?
No, I did not.
Garbage. Absolute garbage. Because it blatantly rips this movie off. Blatantly rips the movie off. And at the same time, the reason for Jonah Hill going downtown is that he wants to get a blowjob. So throughout the whole movie, we're watching him put these kids in a like really perilous situation and these really just unfavorable circumstances just because he wants a blowjob. So it's immediately like, I'm like, I don't like you. I don't like your character. I don't root for you at all. Whereas, and this is where the distinction lies, and this is why no film has ever touched Adventures of Babysitting that has ever tried to rip it off, is because we are behind Chris the entire way. We can totally understand that it's just a really tough situation to be in. It's like, what do? Do you just leave your friend stranded because you're babysitting?
She's freaking out at the
and
same
yeah,
time.
She absolutely is.
And the
it's not an easy decision for her.
No, and the kids force themselves along.
Yes.
The thing that you didn't mention was that the 15-year-old son, who was going out for the night, which is why they were getting a sitter, decided to stick around because he's got a major hard-on for Chris.
Yeah.
And decides to, you know, totally throw a monkey wrench into the night, and as a result, then forces to go along so that he can be on this road trip. And that's where his friend, who he was going to go spend the night over at his place, he ends up tagging along.
Blackmails himself along, actually.
Yeah, no, so it's all blackmail all the time, and Chris is put in a very shit situation. And yeah, you are totally with her, because she's just this innocent girl who's having a really shit night and doesn't know it yet.
Yeah. And from there, we get a series of, you know, you got the flat tire, obviously, something bad would happen. You have the tow truck driver who at first looks menacing and then offers, because, oh, wouldn't you know it, Chris has left her purse back at their house, so she can't pay for the tire. He says, look, it's fine, I'll replace it, you guys are just a bunch of kids in trouble. And then all of a sudden, like, things shift and he kind of goes off on his own story. They're hiding out in a different car. It gets hijacked, taken back to, and suddenly they are in the middle of a major incorporated car thieving ring, and having seen things that they shouldn't have seen, are now on the run from these people. I mean, that's, and from there, things just get more and more out of hand. But again, the whole time, Chris is really struggling to just keep her cool, keep on top of things. I think one of my favorite scenes is that, she starts to really, the situation really starts to hit her, and Daryl says, oh, she's freaking out. She's like, I'm not freaking out. You need to take your medicine, and you should not be eating chocolate, because it's like, and goes back into like full on babysitter mode. But yeah, it's just really fun, because like a lot of the movies we're going to talk about, what we see is we see them going through a very familiar place, in this case, Chicago. And very familiar in the sense that it's just another big city. But the filmmaker's doing such a great job of trying to make the average city at night look like the scariest place imaginable. Like there's even a story about how they were going to be shooting in this alley, and right before they started shooting, the sanitation department comes through and cleans it up. So they had to re-dirty the alleyway, because it was like, no, this isn't scary enough if it doesn't look like an apocalypse has occurred here. Which I think is funny. And I think a lot of these movies do that. A lot of these movies take something very ordinary that we've seen every day, you know, a city at night, and just try to make it look like a fantastical place. And, you know, whether that be for comedic effect or whether to create tension, I think it's really interesting that
they do a really great job of allowing that to be the backdrop for just how absurd a story this is.
Yeah.
Like it's like they kind of throw geography out the window and just go for menacing and crazy, because what's going to happen is a series of completely unbelievable events that are just lead to wonderful hilarity.
Yeah. Well, and throwing geography so out the window that certain parts of Chicago were actually shot in Toronto. So, you know, geography be damned.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that you're just kind of watching. It's like, wait, what city is this set in? Like, it's literally, you're scratching your head going, which city is this?
It's the John Hughes, Illinois.
And
you know?
No, it really is. That she's in the suburbs of Illinois. You kind of wish that they had named it Shermer.
Shermer, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, we're talking about the directorial debut of, and it sucks that we have to talk about this now, because I know the guy is not riding a super high right now, but this is the directorial debut of Chris Columbus.
Yeah.
Which I for the longest time, you know, he was such a great filmmaker, and I still think he is.
And screenwriter.
And screenwriter, and I still think he is. I think he's had a series of shaky choices, to say the least. But I mean, I am a huge fan of this movie, and every Christmas, unironically, I absolutely love Home Alone, and I will watch Home Alone every. In fact, when I was a kid, one of the only two movie posters I had in my room was Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. Like, those movies were really important to my childhood. Like, I totally, Chris Columbus was a very important part of my childhood. It's just, you know, and then when the first two Harry Potter movies came out, and then from there, things get a little dicey, and then, of course, Pixels is the talk of the town this summer for all the wrong reasons.
Directed that.
Yeah, for all the wrong reasons.
It.
No, I haven't either. But part of that, I think, is my refusal to allow this. Like, this is the guy that directed Adventures of Babysitting.
Yeah,
I love Adventures of Babysitting.
Yeah, but it's also the guy who did the Percy Jackson movies.
Yeah, but it's also the one guy who didn't need Spielberg to be an executive producer on his movie to lock up. Like, that Spielberg knew Columbus, you know, personally, and was like, you know, I know you're in line for this gig to direct this movie and you really want it. It's a big studio movie. It'd be great for you. What if I put my name on it? We'll make an Amblin production and then they'll have to hire you. And turns out, didn't even need to do that. Chris Columbus locked up the job without Spielberg's name on it. And to me, that is so impressive. Like mid-80s Spielberg not having to come in and get you the job because you're just that good on your own. I mean, that speaks volumes.
Now, I will say this is his directorial debut, and there's a small little bit in it that just kind of nags at me.
All right.
Because he kind of bends over backwards to suck his own dick a little bit.
Are you talking about the Gremlins reference?
the Gremlins backpack,
yeah,
that we see throughout the entire movie.
He wrote Gremlins,
running around with
the
Gremlins
way.
Backpack.
Yeah.
And it's like, dude, we know you wrote Gremlins. It's a huge hit. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And while I don't disagree, I do think that there are, he also wrote Goonies, by the way. So Gremlins, he wrote Goonies. You're talking about the guy that directed Home Alone, Adventures of Baby. Again, just fucking phenomenal presence in my childhood. But I will say there are some clever references to a lot of things from the lineage of a lot of different people who worked on this movie. For example, the producer of this film is Deborah Hill.
Oh, yeah.
Deborah Hill, who is most well known for all of her collaborations with
John Carpenter.
Yes. I mean, again, while they are trying to make the city look scary at points, I mean, I would not classify this as a horror film whatsoever. But there's a really weird, really kind of appropriate irony about this in that Deborah Hill produces Adventures of Babysitting, which is a great comedy. She also produced Halloween, which is a movie about babysitters getting murdered, which was originally titled The Babysitter Murders. And at one point in the film, if you listen, Sarah, the young girl of the children that she's watching, is watching Halloween on TV, and that's kind of hilarious. So while I don't disagree that he's going out of his way to go, hey, remember Gremlins? He's also paying homage to the lineage of a lot of people who worked on this movie. And then, oddly enough, later on, there's kind of a weird synergy between this film and Back to the Future 3 that Elizabeth Shue is also in at the end, because in both films, she has this weird moment where she kind of wakes up and says, I had the worst nightmare, and tries to kind of write off everything that we've seen as a nightmare. So it's interesting. There's a lot of little like threads that are woven from this movie to a lot of other things. And one of them, I don't want to talk about just yet, because again, that cameo really is the mother of all cameos.
Yeah. Well, you know what I will talk about? One of the things I really love about this movie, one of the things that I think is really fantastic and just it doesn't get enough credit for, is how feminist a movie this is, in that the men throughout this film are pretty useless. They are hot, they're hot-headed, impetuous, cause more trouble than they're worth, and even the protagonist young kid guys are kind of worthless.
Oh, absolutely.
The only people worth a shit in this movie are the women.
Yeah.
You've got Chris, and then you've got the little sister,
Sarah, mm-hmm.
who is super fucking awesome. And by the way, especially for the 80s, really an unusual character, because she is absolutely obsessed with comic books, and particularly Thor.
Yeah.
And which making her one of the most memorable child characters of the 80s,
because very much
it's
so.
Just it's such a great concept, and it's delivered so expertly and so interestingly, and then tied directly into the plot in such a great way, and gives the movie its best moment, because the garage is the centerpiece of this movie. That whole section is just so cool and scary and heartwarming and wonderful. That all comes from this really cool fucking character. But yeah, she's just crazily obsessed with Thor.
Yeah. She wears the little helmet the whole time.
I mean, and carries the...
Mjolnir.
She carries her Mjolnir. And that's why the Gremlins backpack bothers me so much.
It should have been a Thor backpack. I will completely agree.
It should have either been a Thor backpack or it should have been a red cape. Like, that should have been... Yeah. Like,
wait, she is wearing a red cape at one point during the movie.
Yeah, but not... But she's got
the backpack over it.
It's
see.
Just like, you didn't need that.
Listen up, kids. This is an important lesson learned. If you're going to wear a cape, wear it over your backpack. Don't wear your backpack. Because otherwise, why are you bothering to wear a cape? I mean, this is the lesson to take away from Avengers and Babysitting, for sure. And again, one of the commonalities that all the movies we're going to talk about this month share is the very wildly interesting characters that are kind of populating the journey back home. And in this case, I really like Handsome John Pruitt, who is the...
Handsome John Pruitt's great.
Handsome John Pruitt is such a study in contradictions. Like, he appears as like the really scary truck driver
with a hook for a hand,
but then he's a really nice guy, but then somebody comes on the radio and tells him that some guy is at his house shipping his wife, and...
Not just somebody, the cameo.
The... What?
The person who comes onto the radio is...
Oh, that's right.
Is the big cameo.
I thought you meant the person shipping his wife. I was like, wow, I remember this movie very differently. But yeah, and suddenly, and this is kind of speaking to your point, Cargill, suddenly he lets jealousy take over, he gets really blinded by rage, and he just... he goes after the guy at the expense, unfortunately, of Chris's mother's car. And that is kind of how they get stranded, is they're running away from this violent scene. And that's when they sneak into the Cadillac, which is then carjacked by a character called Joe Gipp. And Joe Gipp, this actor, Calvin Levels, who I don't know that I've really seen in anything else, is just so cool. Like, he's just so kind of effortlessly, like, almost to the point that I would believe you if you told me he wasn't a professional actor, but he has been. You know, just looking at his sheet here, he's been in a lot of different stuff. But yeah, he's just like just a very, and again, like, there's all these characters in this movie that are walking this really blurry line between being good guys or being bad guys, or like, what does that even mean? They all really just seem like people who are trying to survive. Which once again plays up the idea of the city being kind of this crazy jungle place. And probably speaking to, like, when we're younger, like, I remember when I was a kid, like, the idea of being downtown at night by myself was kind of a horrifying prospect. And I think that's a fear that a lot of us when we're younger share. And I think that's maybe something that they're playing up in a movie like this by having all these characters who ride that line a little bit between being a character you can like and a character that you're afraid of. And that's all over this movie. And then even like the douchebag frat boys, when Daryl decides he's going to go to a party because all Daryl knows is I want to go to a party. And I love the innocent and lascivious at the same time way that Daryl talks, because when he talks about getting laid, all he ever talks about is I want to go to bed with that girl. I want to go to bed with that girl. Like, that's as filthy as his mind can allow him to be, because the reality of it is he has no idea what he's actually talking about. So that's his term. I just want to go to bed with that girl. So, and that's why it's funny at the frat party when, like, one of the girls says it back to him, and I'm just like, this is the most innocent, like, sexual conversation I think I've ever heard. Like, he's trying so hard to be a horn dog and yet obviously has very little experience.
He's a piss poor Willie Ames. Let's just put it that way. He rates very low on the Ames scale.
On the Ames scale, which is a very real thing that we should patent. We should definitely patent the Ames scale. I think so. Like, I mean, you know,
how
I know
sleazy a best friend is this character?
On the Ames scale, yeah, absolutely. And I want to talk a little bit about Elizabeth Shue getting this role, because there were a lot of actresses who were in line for this part. Which is really remarkable when you consider, again, that Columbus, even though he had written Goonies, he had written Gremlins, had never directed a movie before. And Disney had never released a PG-13 movie before. Like, there were a lot of things about this project that could have really made it go either way and not guaranteed success. And I think it's funny that you had people like Julie Louis-Dreyfus, Jodie Foster, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Valerie Bertinelli, and Justine Bateman, all auditioning, you know, for the role as well. And then this series, this weird series of dominoes happened where when they started talking about Jodie Foster maybe doing it, that's when Julie Louis-Dreyfus backed out. And then Jodie Foster ends up backing out after that, which makes Michelle Pfeiffer the front runner, along with Valerie Bertinelli and Elizabeth Shue, as well as Justine Bateman. And then Bateman withdraws because she's having creative conflicts with the producers of Family Ties. And then Michelle Pfeiffer leaves the project to do Witches of Eastwick. So when it came down to just Valerie Bertinelli and Elizabeth Shue, sorry, Val. Like that's not a tough decision.
She was a shoo-in.
Hey-o.
I had to beat yes. you to that one.
Yes, it's spreading. I love it. Now that the shoe is on the other foot. I love it. And yeah, so it's kind of a long road that finally sees Elizabeth Shue get this role. And I think this may be one of those roles that people most remember her for. Like, I mean, Back to the Future, obviously. Back to the Future 2, she had a significant part in, but she spends most of the two Back to the Future movies she's in asleep. So I think this is, you know, if not the role that most people remember her for, then certainly the role where I think she takes more of a leading front role and really like impresses. And I was very impressed with her. I remember even as a sprat, I was just I liked her very much. I kind of wish that she was my babysitter. She's kind of awesome.
I think this is amongst her most notable roles. Mm-hmm. I would argue that most people probably remember her better for Leaving Las Vegas. But in terms of her junk food material, this is kind of the king of that.
Yeah. Her requisite junk food watching. I mean, this would be high up, probably at the top of that list. But yeah, I mean, there are a lot of really silly things that happen in this movie, but I think it's got... I think, you know, we talked about this feeling like it takes place in John Hughes, Illinois. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that this movie does have a tremendous amount of heart. There's a lot of genuine emotional connection that gets made. There's a lot of things that, you know, watching Elizabeth Shue get put through this ringer because she was trying to be a good friend. I mean, your heart really does go out to her. And then when you find out that fucking Bradley Whitford, his sister was not sick. He was out on a date with another girl. Like, you want her to hit him. You just that sleazy just
God
punch him.
Damn you, Bradley Whitford.
Damn it, Bradley Whitford.
You used to be so cool.
You used to be so cool, and someday you will be eaten by a merman. That will be your penance for breaking the heart of adorable Elizabeth Shue. What is the matter with you? Seriously. And yeah, so you there's just all these little moments where like, and especially with Sarah, like in her moment, and I don't know how much longer we can avoid talking about this.
Let's get to it. So there's if you have not seen this movie, well, you need to fucking see this movie.
You need to see it immediately.
But if you are unspoiled and you have no idea what the mother of all cameos is, maybe now's the time to pause the episode and fucking watch this movie.
Go
right
make
away.
A sandwich.
Because this movie holds up and it's a lot of fun. But that said.
Mm-hmm.
So we finally meet the guy who owns the shop.
Yeah, where Elizabeth Shue's mom's car is now being repaired.
They are $5 short of what they need to get the car back. And sure enough, here comes the owner of the shop. And he comes down in an elevator, you know, hissing smoke, you know, hydraulics. And it's Thor. Motherfucker's got a hammer. He's got the long blonde hair. You know, he's dressed just right to look like Thor.
He's even carrying a hammer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's fucking Vincent D'Onofrio.
It's Vincent D'Onofrio.
Vincent D'Onofrio as Thor. And of course, he's a total fucking jackass. He won't give him the car. And then Sarah has her amazing moment, which is one of the best character moments in the entire movie. I think this whole scene is it really is the centerpiece because, you know, she's brokenhearted because her hero is being an asshole. And she's been looked up to Thor for so long and she's convinced this is Thor. And then she's like, oh, I know why you're being so mean.
You don't have your special helmet. So you're wearing the baseball hat. You're supposed to be wearing this. Take mine. Go on, take it.
Are you giving this to me?
Well, yeah, you're my hero.
And you can tell, and he can tell even within moments of meeting this girl, that this is her most prized possession.
Yeah.
And she's just handing it over. And the Tin Man finds his heart.
Oh yeah, no, and it's great. But he does it in such a great way. It's such a great Vincent D'Onofrio moment, and so well written and directed, because it really is that moment where he softens up. He's being the nice guy. He's letting him off $5 short to take the car back.
Yeah,
and they're like, give me your address so I can say, he's go. Get out. Like, he's still maintaining the I'm a hard ass.
Yeah.
I am not going to be the Captain Softy.
Yeah.
You know, get the hell out of my fucking shop.
Because Captain Softy was never a member of the Avengers. And I think that's the distinction they're trying to make.
Captain Softy should be a member of the Avengers. I mean, there are like literally 400 members of the Avengers.
Yeah.
You could count all the reservists.
You could be all the reservists, the Avengers reserves. 1 weekend a month. That's all you need to serve. In the Avengers,
I think I'm kidding.
No,
actually,
I'm not.
Anyone out there who thinks I'm kidding? Wiki the Avengers reserve list.
There are far too many Avengers. But speaking of this, therefore, could be like. And I remember there was a post credit stinger in this movie.
Yeah,
and it's so funny because of the way that Marvel movies work now, it completely affected my memory because I hadn't watched the post credit stinger in years. And I remember before this most recent viewing thinking it had something to do with Thor. And I'm like, wait a minute. No, it doesn't. I've just been completely corrupted by the way Marvel makes movies now. And I think that's actually Thor. And they're actually setting up a Thor movie. And now I'm like, God damn it. Why didn't they do a Thor movie in the 80s with Vincent D'Onofrio? I would have watched that all day. I would be watching that right now instead of recording. This episode would not be happening because I would be sitting around watching the D'Onofrio Thor every day of the week. I can't believe that didn't happen. It makes me sad.
But the stinger was not about Thor.
It was not about Thor.
It was a guy still hung out on the building.
Bad guy still standing, still just hanging out there. But interestingly enough, in an early draft, I think it was like, they said it was like the third or fourth rewrite of the script, they completely remove Sarah's fascination with Thor. Like, it's not in the script at all. And instead of that moment with Vincent D'Onofrio, it was going to be a scene at Soldier Field with actual Bears players at the time. They'd be like, you know, Jim McMahon and the Refrigerator Perry and so on and so forth, Walter Payton. And what was going to happen is that the two guys of the family are inviting the team to come to their house to watch The Mummy's Curse. And then when they finally leave, Daryl smuggles out a bunch of their jock straps as souvenirs, which are used to make up for the shortage of cash needed that they need to get their station wagon out. What the fuck? Who was in charge of that punch up exactly? Like, I know what let's do. Let's take out this weird thing about the girl being into superheroes and instead turn jock straps into currency. Like, that to me is the exact opposite of what this movie turned out to be, and the exact opposite of why this movie works, and the exact opposite of why we're talking about this being a far more feminist movie than a lot of the movies that came out at the time, is because they did develop female characters that were not only strong but didn't really like fall into a very conventional like mold of like, this is what a female character is in the 80s, you know. And in fact, the ones in the movie who like show up in tertiary roles like that are so forgettable and are so like just kind of comic detritus. Like, they're just there. And I love the fact that you have a character like Chris, who, by the way, has, you know, again, like, interestingly enough, is called Chris throughout the whole movie.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's a really strong sort of like, I don't want to say like gender bending, but like very like gender defiant type of comedy. Yeah. And for the late 80s, like, that is really saying something.
No, and they really did flip the script in that
and then they flipped it back, thank God.
The romantic interest in this movie isn't somebody who swoops in to save her every time she needs saving. He's just the reward.
Yeah.
Like, he's the guy who just falls head over heels for her as just, you know, super nice guy. Mm-hmm. And she keeps ducking out, and he keeps finding her because to prove that he's genuinely interested in her, and it's interesting the way it's done and the way it works.
And it's also really funny that that guy George Newbern, that actor who plays sort of the other love interest that swoops in just to be the helpful guy, is now doing a lot of superhero voices for DC. He does a lot of stuff for Justice League and stuff like that. So
right,
just kind of an odd coincidence there as well. But one of the things I find really interesting about having a discussion about the the more feminist bent to the characters is that this script originally started life in the 70s. Yeah. Apparently, the original idea was that it was going to be Jane Fonda in the role.
Oh, that's kind of crazy.
And then they realized...
There's an alternate reality movie that just, I don't know how I feel about it.
Right. And then they were like, well, Jane Fonda's a little too old. Maybe Bridget Fonda. Bridget Fonda will do it. And then it just kind of went stagnant for a while.
Because they probably couldn't get who they really wanted in the 70s, Christy McNichol.
That could very well be it. But can you imagine, like, right, if this movie...
I could imagine a Christy McNichol Adventures in Babysitting.
Sure.
Like that, the late 70s, early 80s version of that I could imagine.
Yeah.
Jane Fonda, no.
Well, yeah, and I think they realized very quickly that that wasn't going to work. But what I find interesting about the conversation we're having about this movie is that it could have potentially come out. It could have been released at the height of, you know, this burgeoning, you know, women's rights movement, and, you know, in the 70s when, like, the cultural landscape is really changing and gender equality starts to kind of make a big push to the forefront. I'm just like, you know, it makes it even more interesting that we, you know, let it stew for another decade and we still are remarking about how notable the movie is for being as feminist as it is 10 years after that.
Yeah.
So it's just like it's an ongoing thing, and it's very fascinating to me. And obviously something that I did not think about watching this movie as a kid. As a kid, I was just like, man, I want that Thor helmet, or like, man, I wish, you know, she was my babysitter. We went on these crazy adventures. And I think that's another thing, is like the title is so simplistic and just so like it, there's no frills and there's no lying in that title. What is the movie about? It's about adventures and babysitting. That's it. I'm going to sum up the plot by telling you the title. And that's something I always appreciate. But yeah, I want to know if this had been made, let's say, in the early 80s, since this script has been sitting around for a while, if we had to make this movie in the early 80s, who would have played Elizabeth Shue's character?
It would have been Christy McNichol.
Still Christy McNichol.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was unless it was, we go just past that time, then maybe Brooke Shields.
Ah, interesting. I could definitely see Brooke Shields.
I mean, because there was the point at which Christy McNichol had her issues and then vanished. And I think then it would probably be, like, early enough 80s, it would probably be Brooke Shields.
That would be interesting.
And you know who'd be the little girl?
Who would be the little girl?
That would be Drew Barrymore.
Yeah. No, I could definitely see that, especially given, you know, Chris Columbus's ties to Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
That would make a lot of sense. Oddly enough, there were a couple of now pretty notable actresses who tried out for the role of Sarah. One of them being Christina Applegate and another being Nicole Eggert. So those two...
Who would then go on... to do their own, you know, would both go on to sitcoms playing the daughters, although Nicole Eggert would be on Charles in Charge as the older, hotter daughter, and then Christina Applegate would be on Married with Children as the hottest daughter ever.
Mm-hmm.
Neither of them were right for Sarah. The thing about Sarah is she's precocious and adorable and not that type of girl that you look at and you go, that girl's going to grow up to be a super hottie.
Yeah.
She's just so darn adorable.
She really is. And I was just, you know, it's hilarious to me. I just noticed this. Brooke Shields was actually considered for this role as the project was going. Like she was, and I'm looking like the this, list.
These are things that don't surprise me.
This list of people who were, in contention. I don't know how accurate this all is. It is the internet, but names like Sharon Stone, Kelly McGillis, Tatum O'Neill, Melanie Griffith, Andy McDowell, all apparently at some point were considered for the role, or in the case of Kelly McGillis, wanted the lead role, but Chris Columbus turned her down. Interesting.
Kelly McGillis was a little old at the time.
No. I mean, I'm not arguing with his decision whatsoever, I think.
Because she had already starred in Top Gun.
Yeah.
as the flight instructor.
Right. No, absolutely.
Like, oh, no, she's a high school girl.
Let me put forward a theory that Chris is a nickname, but not for Christina or something, you know, something as easy as that. She has her heart broken. Now, one of the things that Bradley Whitford says is he very much denigrates her for being just a high school girl.
And being a prude.
Yeah. What if, you know, when she breaks things off with Bradley Whitford and maybe the, you know, the nice guy doesn't really resurface.
This is a setup for a pun, I'm going
to Maybe she moves to a different town, maybe even a different state, and meets a nice young kid who wants to be a rock star. He's a cool dude, but he's got a good heart, and he spends a lot of time with this weird scientist, though. But I mean, that's really the only drawback.
Oh, it's Grandpa Morty.
He's Grandpa Morty. Yeah. It's just basically what I'm saying is maybe that she goes on to be Jennifer from the Back to the Future franchise, because in both worlds, oddly enough, her last name is Parker. That's really strange to me that her two most notable roles from the 80s, even though they have nothing to do with one another ostensibly, have the same last name. Very strange.
It's a very strange
world we live in.
It's also, you know, incredibly, you know, common name. And,
yeah. No, they're the same person. I mean, essentially is what I'm saying, and I don't think there's any other theory.
It's like what a screenwriter friend tweeted about recently, mentioned the fact that Scott Walker has a name that a lazy screenwriter would write as the name of the president.
Yes, that's true. President Scott Walker.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's Chris Parker and it's Jennifer Parker. Like, yeah, that's so very 80s.
It's, yeah, very much so. But yeah, no, this is a movie that I think, you know, one of my favorite scenes in this movie is when they're on the subway train and then a fucking gang fight is about to break out. And it's just like, seriously, in this train, really? Which, of course, leads to one of my favorite things about PG-13 movies. And then something that we're still really kind of learning about PG-13 movies. And what is the rule with PG-13 movies, Cargill?
Which one?
The one involving the F-bomb.
Oh yeah, you can use the F-word once, but not about fornication.
Exactly. You get one F-bomb. And I think Adventures in Babysitting may have the best use of the one PG-13 F-bomb to this day.
That's debatable.
It's debatable, but I'm going to go with it.
Catch Me If You Can is pretty up there.
Knock knock. Go fuck yourself. That's good. But telling a gang member.
I love how all of a sudden Catch Me If You Can became the Departed.
Knock, knock. His accent in Tom Hanks' Boston accent in that movie would be rivaled later.
I'm not a cop.
By DiCaprio's cop. Boston accent in The Departed.
Just, I'm not a cop. The Departed.
He imparted his Departed accent onto DiCaprio. But my favorite scene is that the gang member, you know what? Actually, I think there are two F-bombs in that movie, because the gang member says, "Don't fuck with the Lords of Hell," which, by the way, great gang name. Yeah, like, you are not messing around with that gang name.
They're very 1980s Hollywood multicultural gang.
Oh, yeah. Like, yes. It's like, to the point that I expected.
Can we get every race possible in
right.
there? And what are we going to call ourselves? The Lords of Hell.
To the point that I half expected Michael Jackson to show up and start singing a song. Like, that's how crazy 80s these gangs are.
Yeah.
And so he says, "Don't fuck with the Lords of Hell." And he throws a knife into Brad's foot. And it's just very, like, it's traumatic. And then she pulls the knife out of his foot, holds it back up to the gang member and says,
"Don't fuck with the babysitter."
To this day, I still think in a PG-13 movie, the F-bomb and how limited you are with using it, you really have to be sparing. You really have to be, you have to choose your moment wisely. And I think that's exactly what Chris Columbus did in that moment. And for that and so many other reasons, not the least of which being that, you know, when they get home and they're like trying to clean everything up and you know, make it look like nothing had happened, has a very Ferris Bueller like ending.
Oh yeah.
In that they're like racing the other car back home. They're trying to, you know, cover their tracks, and it's like you are really rooting for her to, and it's not even to say get away with it is really kind of erroneous, because she really hasn't done anything wrong. She was just trapped in a really horrible situation. And you love her for that. You're rooting for her all the way. And I think it's so easy. I think it was so easy for Elizabeth Shue to kind of fall into that that girl next door, that mode, and she did it so well. And yet she was still so strong and so commendable. Like I think this movie's great. I watch this all the time. I still like to. It's not one of those movies that I watched as a kid that like doesn't hold up. It holds up better now. Like
it really holds up. There's really only one scene in the whole movie that's so absurd that you're just kind of like, okay, and it's still a really fun scene.
Is it the blue scene?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nobody leaves here without singing.
Nobody leave here without singing the blue. And it's true. Nobody left there without singing the blues.
I kind of want to see the bad guys sing the blues.
Yeah. Yeah. At least give it a shot. Yeah. I mean, it's like threatening karaoke. Is what that is. It's like karaoke at gunpoint. It's very, very odd.
I was at a business meeting. Someone stole my Playboy.
What?
They could put us away for 20 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's the thing. I guess we should probably mention the reason the Playboy is such a plot device is that there are, it's like a ledger. Like they have like names of clients and stuff written on it because apparently nobody learned anything from Al Capone. They still write everything down. Very silly. Very, and all in one place, too. Come on. Come on, guys. Get with it. But yeah, any parting thoughts on Adventures of Babysitting, Cargo?
Oh, no. Just, I mean, that it's, I totally agree with you. It holds up. My wife had not seen it since. She said she remembered seeing it as a little kid, but while she was watching it, she's like, I don't remember any of this. And it really held up, and she had a lot of fun with it. And it's a really satisfying family film. That's just a little edgy.
Yeah.
Which is very mid-80s and it is amongst the very best of the edgy things. And it is sad that, Chris Columbus is not directing films like he used to, because there was a time where he was doing some really, really great family fare. And, I always have my fingers crossed. I was really excited about Pixels.
Yeah.
And Pixels was one of those. Once I started hearing the buzz on it, I was really down because I saw some of the early, you know, set photos of it and read the concept. And I'm like, Chris Columbus with Peter Dinklage. And,
We were all on board for that. And then came the words that made me not super on board, but still kind of curious. Adam Sandler.
Yeah. But the thing is Adam Sandler's hit or miss. You know, people love to kick him in the nuts because he makes a lot
way
of bad
miss.
Movies, but he's
way
made a couple of really good ones.
Yeah.
And when he works with the right person, what we should have seen right away was Drew Barrymore wasn't in this. And
yeah.
Had Drew Barrymore been in this, then we should have all been more hopeful. But Drew Barrymore kind of knows how to make Adam Sandler more entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Their last movie together wasn't great, but but I was really hoping. I was really hoping for Pixels because Chris Columbus has done so many great, absurd, family comedies that it seemed like a no-brainer.
And I want to point out that this movie, like a lot of films that are terrific from the late '80s, mid to late '80s, features a Drew Struzan poster, and it's a really beautiful like. It's very classically structured. It's, you know, a bunch of people hanging from a rope, very, very Harold Lloyd kind of stuff. But it's just, it's so beautiful. And every Drew Struzan poster is a work of goddamn art.
Oh, yeah.
And I really love this one. And, you know, just like all the kids kind of hanging off of Elizabeth Shue as she's hanging from a rope outside a building. Like, just again, just kind of speaking to the strength of that character and how much I love Adventures in Babysitting.
Hey, I like danger.
Listen, wait! You should try babysitting.
Which, of course, brings us to the junk food pairing. And this week, I thought I would go with, you know, there are hot dogs, right? There are hot dogs you can buy at the store. And then there are the hot dogs that you can get on the street from a street vendor. And again, it paints a picture in your head of, you know, why would you buy anything from a street vendor? Obviously, that's going to be gross, but if you have ever been in a situation where the hot dog cart is the only thing nearby you, the taste of that hot dog is indescribable. Like if you have ever really gotten from like a real New York or Chicago street vendor a hot dog, they taste different from every other hot dog, but something about them makes them fucking delicious.
It's sitting in that hot dog water for like 6 hours.
Dude, there's no, like science is going to tell you it's going to taste awful. And science may not be wrong, except that it's wrong in this case. And there's a great scene in this movie where Brenda is, she's lost her glasses, she has no money, and she's trying to buy a hot dog with a check. She's trying to sign over a birthday check to the hot dog vendor, leading, of course, to a very silly line about, like, I don't have any cash, well, then I don't have a wiener. But there's something
no
about...
No cash, no wiener.
No cash, no wiener. There's something about that scene that kind of reminds me of, like, when you were a kid at this time and you're watching a lot of the same movies that had a very kind of gentle G rating, very much like Uber Family Fare that you would enjoy, but you knew that, you know, there's just, you were just kind of, you wanted something more. And then, like, out of, you know, like, all of a sudden you get a movie like Adventures in Babysitting, which is a little more rough around the edges in terms of its content and in terms of how crass it's willing to be and the kind of thing, like aiming for a little bit higher age range of the kids that are watching. And man, you feel so satisfied. Like, it may be for all the wrong reasons, but man, you really feel satisfied as a kid when you watch Adventures in Babysitting. And I think that's exactly why, is because you were hungry for something a little bit different, and that's exactly what you got. So yes, street vendor hot dogs, definitely the junk food pairing of Adventures in Babysitting. And that's going to do it for this week's show. Join us back here next week when we will be talking about Judgment Night.
Judgment Night!
Which has nothing to do with vampires or Terminator robots. I will just warn you right now, if you are mistaken about what movie we are actually talking about, because I would venture a guess that the next two movies, like this series is going to start with the most people have seen movie one, a few less people have seen movie two, or probably a lot less people have seen movie two, and then maybe a handful of people have seen movie three. Like, we're getting a progressive decline in the notoriety of these films. But yes, we'll be talking about Judgment Night next week.
Isn't that what we do every month? Don't we always save the single most obscure one for the end of the month?
Maybe.
Like Freebie and the Bean last month, and then the month before that, Last American Virgin.
What?
Last American Virgin.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We did Last American Virgin last. Yeah. I guess that is what we do. I'm never really conscious of that.
No. We've never, like, it's not like we map it out, but we're
going to talk about these four movies, and then we just kind of spread them out on the table and go, okay, this one first. Yeah. Like, that's as scientific as we like to get, but it works. And if you would like to hear more of those past episodes, you can go to iTunes or you can go to Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at JunkFoodCinema or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/JunkFoodCinema. Cargill, where can people find more of you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Facebook, facebook.com/MassaWyrm. That's MassaWyrm. Or on Twitter at MassaWyrm.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury or on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. Or you can also find me at oneofus.net, my home away from home. Lots of geek podcasts and blogs over there for every taste. Definitely check that out. But I want to close this show with a piece of advice that when I was younger and in my more vulnerable years was given to me by someone very wise, and I've been turning over my head ever since. Don't fuck with the babysitter.